Namaste, friends, and welcome to The World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that we have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, Phil.
Happy Friday. We've made it to the end of another week. We've been working our way through Thomas Frey's 72 stunning things in the future that will be common 10 years from now. And when we concluded on Wednesday, I said we're talking about our favorite topic. I don't know that it's our favorite. It's one of our favorites. But
we talk about it a lot. We really do.
It's one we hit all the time.
It's just interesting. Yeah. We hit it a lot because we see it happening before our eyes, self-driving cars, and it's going to have a huge impact on the world. And so, yeah, we do talk about it quite a bit, but we're going to approach it from several different angles tonight. So,
absolutely. Well, yeah. A couple weeks ago, we talked about how much progress has been made over the past 11 years, basically the last decade. And so tonight, we're going to peek ahead, letting Thomas Frey be our guide as to some things that may be reality within 10 years from now related to self-driving cars. So let's jump. And plus, we're going to do some other geek. So let's have a look. The first one, queuing stations for driverless cars as a replacement for a dwindling number of parking lots. I think that is a really interesting idea, and I think that's I would classify.
Help me picture this, Phil. Help me picture this. What are we talking about here?
Well, I would classify this under a larger heading that I would just call alternative parking. Okay. Now, parking is still very much a human-centric activity. But parking will become something that machines do, and people don't have to be in the car anymore when it when it happens. So whether you're talking about actually filling a garage, or whether you're talking about cars lined up on the street, or cars lined up out in a field, or something like that, it's a self-organizing approach that will be much more efficient in its use of space than what we currently see. If you walk in,
I've got in my head two pictures. Then I've got the parking garage from that Mission Impossible movie. I forget which one it was. It may have been Ghost Protocol. It was basically a parking garage that robo parked the cars. And at the climax of the movie, there was a fight in that garage. And that was, while the cars are being shuffled around, there's a
right.
fight going on.
It's exactly that, except the automation belongs to the cars, not to the garage. There's no reason to have that level of, sophisticated car moving around technology, because the cars can do it themselves, right? So
right.
If you picture, and there shouldn't be people in there, right? Because it's a dangerous thing where the cars are just moving themselves around, and people are already should be out of the picture. But obviously, Mission Impossible, you want to create those kinds of situations. But picture your average parking lot. Look how much space is wasted by driveways. By space between cars so people can get in and out. None of that space has to be wasted now, because what happens is the cars they can line up right on top of each other, and as long as there's one open space somewhere in the lot, as soon as anybody needs to get out, a few things can move around and that car can get out, right? It's not something that you can do today, because everybody would have to come back and move their car, and that's all anybody would ever do, would be move cars around just for a little bit of extra efficiency with parking lots. But if you look at your typical downtown area, this is one of the big problems, right? Is where do we put all the cars? People pay a lot of money for parking spots, and now there's all kinds of possibilities for what you could do. For one thing, I think parking lots could become anywhere from 20% to 40% more efficient than they currently are. But there's other options too. Have the car drop you off at home, and then it can go at work, and then it can go back home, right?
Yeah.
You know, maybe
your car could be parked in the suburb and then come get you at the end of the day.
Yeah, or not even parked.
Of course, you're
burning
more gas that way, but it's a solution to the crowded streets. I saw something, and this is an old picture, Phil. This is something from the 60s or something, an idea that's never, to my knowledge, really been implemented, but it seems so obvious. What it was a basically, imagine a Ferris wheel for cars, okay? But instead of being round or a complete wheel, it's just, the car goes up one side and then goes over the top and comes down, and so it is as wide as basically two parking spaces, but it could be 10 stories tall. And when you come up to that two parking space wide thing and just, punch your ticket in, your car, which might be way up at the top of the thing, comes down and, you pull out and you leave. You get all the benefit of a parking garage with a whole lot less infrastructure. It seems to me that's such an obvious idea.
Yeah, and again, I think if we want to make infrastructure investments, we'll go that way. But what I picture is you can now tell your car, go do something. I'll see you in a while.
Yeah.
Right.
Basically. Yeah. Go be an Uber car for the day and earn me some money, car.
Exactly.
And then
go
come pick me
money,
and then come pick me
five.
Up.
That's right.
Yeah.
Those are go get the kids from school. Go pick up some shopping, some products that are ready to be delivered to the home. I mean, all kinds of options. The point is, this problem of paying to have a space that your car can occupy becomes a completely different set of logistical challenges and opportunities with the self-driving car. And that's going to be cool because we're going to have, as the second item says, crash-proof cars. Volvo already says their cars will be crash-proof before 2020. And I assume by crash-proof that means it's just so smart and so safe that it won't get in a wreck. Is that presumably what they're...
I hesitate to say anything will be ever crash-proof.
What Volvo means.
I think that what they probably mean, it's a marketing term, and I think that they mean that their cars are going to be so much safer than what we have currently that it could be said to be practically crash-proof. But, there's always a chance for a mishap. Yeah,
I don't think we'll have crash-proof cars before 2020 or before 2120, sadly. That's never going to happen. What will happen is you statistically get closer and closer to zero, but you don't hit zero. But I think it's primarily not about making it able to sustain impacts better. We've been working on engineering that end of it for the last few decades, right? Making crashes more survivable. This is making it less likely to have a crash, right? And that's ultimately what a self-driving car is. It's a car that doesn't want to get in a wreck way more than it ever did before, because cars didn't used to want anything, right? But now here's a car with a goal. And the number one goal of your car will be not to get in a wreck, right?
Right, right. And number two goal is get you to where you say you want to go.
That's right.
But the number one goal is always no wreck. I think that's
it's the laws of robotics. Asimov's laws of robotics written into cars. So yeah, Volvo's shooting for the first law of robotics in their cars, and go for it, Volvo. And I hope they get us as close there as possible. Driverless car hailing apps. Much like signaling Uber and Lyft, only without the drivers. 10 years from now, you think?
Oh, it's already being experimented with right now, Phil. I saw an article this week he's basically somebody. I think that they brought somebody over from what's the Uber of your of homes? What do they call that? Airbnb. An executive brought over from Airbnb to Uber. I kind of gave a little talk on it, and they're beginning testing of driverless cars as part of Uber now. And of course, their Uber drivers are not particularly happy to hear this, but it's the future. So
I read that in Singapore you can now hail a self-driving taxi. That they've actually started offering that there. So yeah.
So yeah, will it happen in 10 years? It'll happen in 5 years.
Yeah,
this will be on us.
We're already seeing it happen. Okay, large fleet ownership of driverless cars. Some companies will own millions of driverless cars. What are these
millions? That's a lot. It must be a huge company to have millions. But yeah, I think you'll see. Large fleets, and I think they'll have some sort of almost a hive mind mentality, Phil. I mean, they'll be networked to one another in such a way to, you know, hand off things. You know, maybe one car has some packages or something in it, and but you know, it needs to hand it off to another car in the swarm, right?
Exactly.
And I think all of this could happen without a human being involved.
Well, when I think of a large fleet of cars, I think of like Hertz, you know, Budget. These are the companies that own large fleets of automobiles today, and that whole model gets shaken up in the next 10 years as self-driving cars become a reality, because that is one of the clunky, up there with parking, right? One of the clunky, just big pain in the ass things you have to deal with in travel is your rental car. You know, it's like this added step of hassle that you don't want to have to deal with, to the extent that,
people living in places like New York City, for years, people have not owned cars.
Right.
You know, if you live in an Upper East Side apartment, and you might choose not to own a car at all, and then when you need to go out of town, you'll rent a car, right? And I think that sort of model maybe gets pushed down a little bit to other parts of the country. You know, I mean, we don't. There's something to be said for owning a car, and people have pride in ownership. This beautiful car, you know, this guys that have a muscle car or a big jacked up truck or something, these, you know, they love their vehicle, right? But much of the rest of us, we don't, you know, it's not the vehicle that we love. We love the freedom of movement, right? And so, you know, you don't necessarily have to own a vehicle for that. Well, imagine if, you know, it's the Hertz driverless car that's picking you up every morning and taking you to work, and it goes and does its thing throughout the day, transporting other people. Maybe it's Hertz, maybe it's Uber, maybe who knows? It's sort of a combination of the models, right? And you just have a contract with these people. You know, whenever you need a car, they you know, we can have a car to you in 5 minutes, kind of guarantee almost, right?
Absolutely. I think we'll see these companies, like, if they're smart, companies like Hertz and Budget, they're going to morph into Uber and Lyft with their big fleets, where you have like a reliable service, maybe. You know, currently, there's not a fleet. There's this ad hoc fleet of anybody's car that wants to show up when you hail Uber or Lyft. But what if it's like you have a regular service you use, right? So I don't own a car, but I'm a Hertz guy. You know, Hertz always.
Yeah.
It's almost like being a Chevy guy used to be, right? It's like, well, I work with Hertz, and so when I'm here at home, that's how I get around. And when I fly someplace else, I've got a Hertz account, and you know, I rack up quite a few miles. There could be like loyalty programs related to that, and businesses vying for it. You know, repeat business and kind of a share of that. That would be a real application, I think, for these big fleets.
Right. Right. And will it happen in 10 years? I think as we've mentioned earlier in the week, there's some things that the transition won't have completely occurred in 10 years, but it'll go from being some wild idea that we're just throwing out there to conventional wisdom in 10 years. And I think we'll be well on our way.
We'll see. All right, how about this? Electric cars will routinely win major races like the Daytona 500, Monaco Grand Prix, and the Indy 500. Well, this isn't really self-driving cars.
Tesla has kind of proven from its very beginning that you can have a very fast electric car. Electric engines have more torque naturally than internal combustion engines anyway, and so that makes you faster off the start, right? And provided that it's able. That you got batteries that can provide the power it needs to go long distances too.
Right.
Then yeah, you could routinely have you know, and so you would need, what you would need is for something like the Indy 500 race, for an electric car to win it, you'd want to have a battery stack that could be pulled down and then replaced with a completely different battery pack on the you know, as fast as they can they change out tires, right? And I think that's completely doable.
That is achievable. My question is, won't the rules have to change? You couldn't enter an electric car in one of those races today, right? Even if you had one that was viable.
I confess to not knowing enough about the rules.
I'm guessing the standards bodies would have to say it's okay, and they might be the thing that keeps that from happening, actually.
And it could very well be that, you know, there's, you know, part of the excitement of racing is the roaring of the engines as they go down the road, you know,
right,
go down the track, and they find that silent race car racing just doesn't draw the crowds.
Well, because if you talk about the main topic here, if there were self-driving cars, it would just be a lot less interesting, right? If there's no driver.
That's right.
You know? So yeah. some technological...
We got the MIT team versus Google out here, and that just doesn't, you know, it's not the same.
But is there any doubt that ultimately a self-driving car would win, right? You give everybody identical cars, and one of the drivers is a optimized AI, it will win the race, right? And it won't have a wreck. You know, so it's like it would be higher performance, just like these electric cars are higher performance. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the sport will go that way, and, you know, any more than we'll be watching robots play NFL or, you know, name your analogy. So that one's interesting. I think definitely the capability will exist. Will the sports go in that direction? We'll find out. I'm not convinced that in 10 years that will be happening. Maybe they'll be demoing it. Maybe there'll be new races for the electric cars, right, and new races for the self-driving cars. How about in-car work and entertainment systems to keep people busy and entertained as a driverless car takes them to their destination? This, for
of
sure.
Course.
I mean, we have these for passengers now anyway. Now we just need them for the front seat, right?
Right.
You know,
and one that doesn't turn on unless the AI is fully engaged, right?
Right.
You know, you'd have that safety feature built in to where you can't turn on the front DVD system /internet/ everything else unless the AI is driving you. I will that happen? You better believe it will. That will for sure happen.
Now, this relates to the next one. In-car advertising will be a delicate balance between offsetting the cost of operation and being too annoying for the passengers. I would presume that where you would see that advertising would be primarily through the entertainment system, although not necessarily. You can, you know, there's a lot of augmented reality applications potentially with a fully modernized vehicle. Your windshield could become an augmented reality interface, and since you're not, you know, looking out for real-time, I'm driving the car information, you're looking at the scenery, but you're also being maybe notified that there's a business over here that you might be interested in. You know, there's products available here, food available here, you know, sites of interest, all kinds of possibilities where those kinds of ads could pop up. I could see kind of contextual advertising being a lot better than just, now I got to sit through ads, right, because that's how my car is programmed. That would be pretty irritating, I think.
You know, interesting side note. Here in Louisiana, it is perfectly legal for there to be digital billboards, and I'm sure y'all have them in Colorado, I'm sure.
Yep.
Where, you know, it's multiple advertisements on billboards, and it'll cycle between the advertisements, right? And these digital billboards, I'm seeing them more and more. But I found it interesting. I talked with an advertising guy because I have to do some advertising for my business, and they said, yeah, it's perfectly, you know, an easy thing. These are full screens, and we could put video on those screens, but it's completely illegal. And what do you mean? Yeah, we found that video was way too distracting for drivers,
right?
And it was causing accidents, and so it just cycles between still images. And so, you know, if you want to be on our billboard as a still image, that's fine, but you know, you can't be on a billboard waving at people or something. You know, that's just not happening. It's still images only. I thought that was interesting. So, yeah, I think there's, you know, if it's inside the car too, again, if it's advertising or whatever, you would need to make sure that the self-driving car is self-driving at the time that the advertisement is being delivered. I think that's the first and foremost concern there.
Yeah, and ultimately the billboard becomes kind of like the parking lot, right? It's this infrastructure that belongs to a different era. Where, you know, well, everybody's driving by, so hopefully they'll glance at our billboard as they're going by. You'll need that less when the cars are capable of delivering individualized, personalized information. You know, the billboard.
What if you agreed, Phil, in exchange for the ride to your destination, that you would be bombarded with advertisements the entire way, and then you got a free ride?
Yeah, I might, or if I wouldn't, there are people who would anyway.
I want it quiet today. No advertisements. I'm paying for the ride today.
Yeah. I think there's an interesting offset there, and it's moving towards the attention-based economy. So this is an interesting observation that Frey is pointing us towards. We talk about how do you get to an attention-based economy. Turns out self-driving cars help push you in that direction. That you can choose between paying for something with your money or paying for it with your attention. We know that from websites, and it'd be very interesting to see that applied to something like getting from point A to point B. All right, next is electric car charging in less than 5 minutes. Certainly, if we get the hot swap battery model for race cars applied to general electric cars, electric cars available for the general public. I'm not sure that GE is going to be selling electric cars. That'll work.
They might, but.
but also just the idea of, you know, some way to super blast a battery and get it charged up in less than 5 minutes, that's going to be important. Ultimately, there has to be something to do that, or that's one of the reasons that electric cars, you know, currently that is a problem associated with electric cars, isn't it, the charging time?
Yeah. Absolutely. It's, you know, and so what you do is with people today is that they charge overnight, and you know, if you can get a couple hundred miles on a charge, being able to charge overnight is generally good enough. But what if you need to go on a long trip? And,
right.
And so if, you know, there are ways of charging quickly, and by quickly, we mean like 10 to 15 minutes. That's a lot slower though than filling up with gas, isn't it?
Right.
And if you could swap the entire battery pack out quickly, you know, something comes up underneath your car, your battery pack drops out, it comes out, and a fully charged battery pack comes in and snaps into place, and you're good to go as fast as a fill up on at the pump, right? I could see something like that working. You wouldn't need technology that we really don't have now. You just have to get the infrastructure in place.
There it is. So I think that's one we can definitely look for. And I've added my own, which is the sleeper car. We've talked about this idea before, but I think it fits on this list because I think we'll see some implementation of that idea. If we're looking at in-car entertainment systems for people who are essentially all passengers in the car, the idea of, choose a 8-10 hour destination drive away, where people typically fly for business for those kinds of things now, and then they rent a car when they get there. Another option is, well, it's just one more night away. I'll drive, right? Car will drive. I'll sleep in the car, and I'll get there. I'll do my stuff, and then the car will drive me back.
We've already seen of the beginnings of this, Phil, in the post 9/11 world. Prior to 9/11, people would, not think too much about taking a flight from Shreveport to Dallas. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now that's about a 3.5 hour drive. Okay.
Right.
But I mean, you know, it's take a flight and that makes it a 45 minute hop. And so, but here's the thing, post 9/11, you got to show up at the airport, you know, an hour or two early.
Right.
You got to submit to the pat down and they didn't even buy me a hamburger first,
Exactly.
A pat down deal. and everything else associated with flying, people don't take airplanes on short hops like that. I think if you add, you know, the fact that your car can drive you without you even being involved to the picture, all of a sudden you're pushing that further, you know, the distance that you're willing, you know, to travel by ground becomes greater and greater, you know, as opposed to jumping in an airplane.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, you're realistically comparing the time and the amount of control you have over the process. And it's like, well, when the time is about the same or even less to drive and you have full control over the process, it's just a better deal, right? I mean, it's just,
yeah.
You know.
And you don't have to deal with hurts when you get there, right? I mean,
right.
You got your car at your destination. So
exactly. You're in control. Yeah. You leave when you want. You get there when you want. It's the one thing we'll need for sleeper cars, or I picture sleeper, you know, vans for families, is, you know, at some point you got to get someplace where you're actually staying. You know, there needs to be a shower involved at some point. Sleeper cars get pretty nasty after a couple of days, I would think, if you're just using that as your, well, it's like living in your car, right? Not the best model in the world.
If you're using if we're thinking of a Hertz Uber model, maybe every, you know, you grab your bags out of it, and then the following night it's a different vehicle that's been cleaned up, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So that, you know, that's going to be very important. Big growth business in the next 10 years is going to be car interior sanitization. It's going to be huge because of all this reusing of cars. That, you know, people in and out of cars. It's going to become. But you think about how nice most people keep their Uber cars, right? They're really working on that. And right now, you got people doing that. When they become self-driving cars, there's going to have to be a solution to that. So we'll look for that as kind of a potential challenge that has to be overcome in the era of the self-driving car. Okay, let's move to other geeks. Steven, I'll tell you what, you got your choice of topics. I see you've lined us up with two, and there's no way we have time for both of these, so pick one.
I'm going to pick one and run with it. Suicide Squad. Saw it last night. Enjoyed it, Phil. This thing has a 26% score on Rotten Tomatoes, and it's a fine movie. I enjoyed it very much. You know, it's kind of the plot of Escape from New York. You got a reluctant hero that's, you know, you got to be a hero because if you don't, we're going to kill you. You know,
right, right.
And so they have a group of people that they do that, and the good guys are not all that good, and the bad guys aren't all that bad, and it's a post Superman world, you know. The world changed when Superman flew, and then it changed again when he wasn't flying anymore. You know.
Yeah. So it's set after the end of Batman versus Superman. It's set in
that. Exactly. And Batman makes some cameos, and there's another cameo or two in there too. And stay for after credits. It's got an interesting after credits sequence like the Marvel movies do, and. What else? I mean, I just found it remarkable that it got such a low score. I don't know what the critics thought was lacking in this film. It had its moments of being funny. It was certainly exciting and interesting. Margot Robbie turned in a performance. I think if she wasn't a movie star already, she certainly is now.
Mm-hmm.
And she played Harley Quinn, she just crazy and funny and, you know, sexy and all that. She's just all, you know, and so she was a huge star, and Will Smith was great as always.
Fan rating for Suicide Squad?
I'd have to look it up real quick. You have that
way higher than 26%, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's way higher. Now I think it's one of those things that some fans were a little disappointed with. And so, I don't know. I just don't. I don't get it. And I compare it to something like Ghostbusters, this year's Ghostbusters that the fans didn't like. Now I haven't seen Ghostbusters. I can't comment on whether it's a good or bad movie. I haven't seen it. But a lot of fans hated it, and the critics are at 76% on it on Rotten Tomatoes, while the fans didn't like that. And let me just see. Trying to find it real quick. Suicide Squad. Yeah, 26% Rotten Tomatoes. And I'm trying to see where the fan rating. Audience score. 68%.
Yeah, so quite a bit higher on the fan side. The thing is, both of those scores, I was talking about this, was it last week or a couple weeks ago, where if something is just generally despised, I want to give it a look because I think that, it's like
the critics have it right. I mean, if the critics just absolutely lambast something and I basically was drugged to this movie last night.
You're talking like there's some Stephen, you're talking like there's some objective right. Which would be what exactly? It's all groupthink, okay? The problem with these scores is it's like with the stock market, it's all overreaction all the time, right? So these things that get 99.9% are probably okay movies. They're probably pretty good movies, but everybody went in expecting it to be the best thing of all time. So it is.
Yeah.
And now the critics.
Yeah, and you'll walk out with all the same problems you walked into the movie with. It's not. it's not gonna cure the problems in your marriage.
Yeah, that's right. If you need a root canal, you're still gonna need it at the end of the movie. That's exactly right.
Ghostbusters, 57% of the movie going public gave it a positive rating, 73% of critics liked it. This is the exact opposite. Except 26% of critics. And I'm reading things like complete mess, can't figure out what the plot is. I don't get that. I mean it's the easiest plot ever. I mean, you got a bunch of bad guys that are metahumans, superhuman bad guys that are recruited to go take on another even worse guy, right? And if they don't, they're killed. And so they play along, or they sort of do. And the tension that's constant between do I do bad things or do I do this good thing and save my own life or whatever, it's. That is not a hard plot to understand, and it's fun and interesting how, I found it a good movie. I do not understand that at all. So, anyway, can we trust movie critics? Sometimes we can, sometimes we can't. We couldn't hear. So.
Okay, and I'm sorry, Stephen, but that's a big lesson learned for you? I mean,
come on. Touché.
What's interesting is the groupthink, right, is that they all seem to team up. Just like the fans now, when it used to be, you would read an individual review, right? You had a critic that you trusted, maybe your local newspaper, or you'd read Roger Ebert or something like that, and it was like, okay, well, generally this individual gives me good advice. Now it's like this group, and they act as groups, right? I mean, there's like this coordinated, and I don't think it's not a conspiracy, it's not intentional. It's just there's this dynamic that somehow takes over, and what we're seeing is this emergence of two different kind of countercultures to each other, right? The critic's view of movies versus the public's view of movies, which you expect to be, more or less in sync, with some big differences. Every now and then, the public loves a movie that critically is just not a well-made movie, or vice versa. The critics go nuts over something, and the public says, "Well, that's boring. I don't want to watch it." That's the diversion you expect. But what's interesting now is, the fans write the reviews too. They're criticizing based on the same set of criteria, basically, as the film critics, right? So the question becomes, do we need critics anymore?
And with certain kinds of movies, I pay attention to the critics more than with others. I have them on a sliding scale because with certain films, like superhero movies, I listen to them less than I do the fans, okay? Because critics don't get superhero movies by and large. To me, if the fans of superhero movies, enjoyed a superhero movie or maybe a Star Trek movie or a Star Wars movie or something like that, if the fans of those kind of movies think it's great and I'm a fan of those kind of movies, I'm probably going to think it's great. Right. Whereas if it's some sort of other type of movie, I need to listen to the critics closely because they're in tune with that kind of movie better. So I guess the thing is you need to listen to the people that are know about a particular genre of movie because if you're listening to some critic who, loves period dramas on whether or not you should go see Suicide Squad, you're probably not getting a fair opinion.
Right.
So,
And for sure, You want to be real careful watching fan reviews of movies because, you know, the fan base that you see on Rotten Tomatoes or any of the rest of these is heavily who is it they say all movies are made for is this, like, demographic of, like, the 18-year-old male.
Yeah,
right?
The lowest common denominator problem, idiotocracy kind of thing. Well,
right.
And there's also the sunk cost problem. I mean, you know, the average person doesn't go see as many movies as a critic does, right?
Right.
And so, you know, when a normal person lays down the money and goes into the movie, they have sort of a sunk cost problem, okay?
Yes.
I've paid for the movie. I'm here. I'm going to have a good time with this movie.
Right. I'm going
and,
to have a good
you know,
time.
And I'm going to find something to enjoy in this movie, even if it's kind of crap. Right?
That's right. That's right.
And whereas a critic who sees, you know, four movies a week doesn't deal with the same issue and will call something out that's crap faster than someone who sees movies rarely. So you got that issue too. So, yeah, you can't trust the general public and you can't trust critics either to some extent, but you should listen to all of it and form your own, you know, and then decide whether or not to skip a movie or not. So
or listen to as much of it as you want to, you know.
Right.
To me, the fact that you can go on Rotten Tomatoes in a movie like, Captain America Civil War ranks identically with Schindler's List or something.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it tells you that fan ratings are worth what they're worth, okay? It's like, okay, well,
yeah.
that doesn't tell me what
well,
I'm going
to
watch.
Well, to me, I think they're both fantastic movies. And
well,
you talk about comparing apples and oranges, you know, I mean.
That's the problem, right? You know,
there's a huge apple and orange problem with Schindler's List and Civil War. I think, and here's the thing, I'll probably see Civil War, you know, a dozen times before I'm, before I'm done with life. But Schindler's List, I've seen it twice, and I might see it once more. And that's about all I need to see that movie, you know. It's,
yeah.
It's kind of a long slog, and it's kind of tough, and it leaves you a little bit depressed for a day or two after watching it.
Right.
So.
Well, but the point is, you know, what are we ranking? If you rank one of them 100%, you know, if everybody says it's awesome, one of them is being ranked as an entertainment experience, one is being ranked as a work of art. Theoretically, critics are evaluating art. The fans are evaluating an entertainment experience, right?
Right.
And those two things have been hopelessly convoluted. Plus, there's just all these other agendas. I'm a DC fan, so I'm going to say I like this even if I don't, right?
Right.
The Marvel Cinematic Universe must never be allowed to have done anything wrong. Therefore, I'm going to like this, and I'm going to tear to shreds anybody who doesn't like it. You know, I mean, there's those kinds of loyalties.
Well, and there's also political agendas. I think that there's a tendency, there was a tendency perhaps, with the female Ghostbusters, for example, for the critics to try to pull it across the finish line, you know,
Maybe.
It wasn't as quite as good of a movie as they wanted it to be.
That could be your 16.
And I'm saying that not having seen
the
movie.
Fans and the, yeah, I haven't seen
yeah.
I haven't seen either of them, so I can't comment on the merits of either of those two movies. I'll eventually see both of them probably, and so, you know, once they're on the.
Oh yeah, I'll catch this year's Ghostbusters at some point, but
I'll see them eventually, and then I'll be like, well, yeah, maybe they're, I don't know, but you know, at the end of the day, trust yourself, right? You know if you like a movie or not,
I don't know, Phil. I was drugged to Suicide Squad. I mean, I then thoroughly enjoyed it. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
occasionally these things are going to just surprise you.
Yeah, it's like go see a movie and then read the reviews, right? And see if they were right. Right? Start becoming your own authority on these things, I think, is there's something to be said for that. And then you go write the review on Rotten Tomatoes, right? Let's start driving this process rather than being victims of it. I think that's the takeaway. Because, you know, people like anybody listening to this program, right, you're thinking about the future. You're thinking about these issues. You're a geek. You know, get out there and help shape this. Or become a professional critic and help fix those professional critic scores. I think those are all good ideas. So I'm feeling positive about it. I'm coming away from, I know, Stephen, you raised a problem, but I feel like there's a lot of good action we can take to fix this. And the most important one is go see movies and have a good time. I think we can all agree on that. All right. Well, that does it for another week of The World Transformed. Look forward to next week's Other Geeks, Stephen, because I know you got more good stuff to share. We're going to wrap up our series next week. We got three more shows to do on Thomas Frey's list. We're also going to have our 200th World Transformed show next week. So big stuff coming up. Stephen, it's been great talking with you. Thank you all for being with us. And until next time, live to see it.